Hey, Bob.
I hope the intensity of the last half hour of music is an appropriate introduction to the intensity of your new video.
A wonderful lead-in. Thank you very much. You liked it, Ben.
Oh, yeah, it's excellent. We're going to go through it. Look at Ben. Ben says, this is a groove. Woo-hoo. Sorry, Ben. We had to stop. We have a prearranged appointment with Clinton. Clinton's made a tremendous video. I wanted to create some kind of hyper intensity to approximate the intensity of research that Clinton had to do. How he found this stuff, I don't know where it comes from. Maybe there's documentaries or old shows. It's pretty amazing, Clinton, what you have found. Now, what I want to do is to go through, not listen to the thing, it's 34 minutes, but I'm just going to try to look at the first part and see what I think of it, what I did come to, and see where you're going. Is the main arc of this how we were able, or the Alan Kay and the inventors took us through the window. Is that the basic point? We're going through the vanishing point. We're going through the window of a screen, and we get on the other side. That's about where you get about halfway through the documentary. Is that what?
Yep.
All right.
I'd say so.
All right. So no one. We begin with the famous archetypal footage of the big building-sized computers and what are they called? Reel-to-reel or mainframe? What are those original big things called?
They were called computers, and then if it was the size of a refrigerator, that was a mini-computer. But mainframe is a good term for them, too, yeah.
Okay, so let's see. You got. I'm not going to have you hear it. I'm just going to move forward and then give you the footage imagery and what I think is going on, and then you explain what's really going on. So it begins talking with, what is his name? Maybe I can hear it. Well, who's this Charlie Chaplin guy? Where did that, how did that happen?
IBM, when they were marketing their PCs to compete with Apple and Commodore and Tandy, their whole marketing gimmick was to use Charlie Chaplin in all of their commercials. I don't know why, but there's a whole ton of commercials on for IBM PCs with this impersonator, Charlie Chaplin impersonator.
Do you know who he is?
I don't know who the impersonator is. I know who Charlie Chaplin is.
Yes, but the impersonator, we don't know who this guy. Maybe a lot of people could do it. And when would this have been made? Is this around their entry in 81 or before?
Yeah, it would have been 81, right up to around 83, 84. This was the marketing theme for PCs.
Right. Now, then, after that, so you begin with McLuhan, and then you show the Charlie Chaplin. And why is he bouncing around Chaplin? Is it because he doesn't have any computer? Is that what's going on there? Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't have a computer to do his office work for him.
And he's getting knocked around. Okay. So the first thing that comes up is this guy who witnessed the robbery. The digital research has come up with something. And they offer it to IBM, and IBM says, yes, you can, we'll take it if you deny you gave it to us. Did I get that right?
Yeah, we'll take it, and we'll rename it, and you can't talk about it. Yeah, exactly. It was a total ripoff.
Right, so that is the icon, and we'll call that the TV body. That's the iconography that the corporations ride on. They must continue to appear to be at the top. That's more important than the fucking ethic. You know what I mean? Mm. It's impersonal. It's corporate. It's not human. Because if they give credit to this digital research, then all the attention shifts to digital research, right? And they can't afford that.
IBM hated the microcomputer industry. They were a bunch of dope-smoking hippies who, you know, we're selling people stuff, right? That's why it took so long for IBM to jump into the market. They were 6 years late.
Yeah,
they had no respect for the, you know, cheap 8-bit piece of junk desktop personal computers, right? They were real computers, damn it.
And what were those real computers? Were they analog?
No, they were digital computers, but for instance, the CPU wouldn't be one chip. It would be like an entire circuit board, right? The hardware was so much larger because every circuit was, it wasn't all integrated into a single chip. There was no integrated chips in the 50s and 60s, right? Or in the 50s.
So who is using the new chip first? Gates and Jobs and those guys? Or it's a little later?
Yeah. The chips were invented for calculators. And so that's when you get tinkerers and experimenters in the late 60s and early 70s. You end up with MITS in 1975 selling the Altair, which is who Bill Gates and Paul Allen sold their BASIC interpreter to, and that's what started Microsoft off. So, yeah, right. It was all hobbyists playing with these new integrated circuits and microchips and processors and stuff.
Yeah, I wasn't in school at the time, but I saw younger people, early 70s, with their calculators. That was the first popular chip use?
Yep.
Yeah, because I think there's a sentence in your documentary there. And so somebody started looking at these calculators, maybe Gates and these guys, and then started playing with the chipness of it all, right? And
Yeah.
And then the stupid IBM, they don't understand the chip. What do they think? They're supposed to be experts. Like, what is this rearview mirrorism they got themselves into? How come they don't recognize the miniaturization or the chippiness that's starting with the kids' calculators? What are they missing there?
Yeah, well, they didn't respect the idea of one computer to one user, the idea of a personal computer. They saw a computer as part of an institutional workflow. And so it was something that, you know, it was the size. They did have chips, but their computers would still be the size of a refrigerator, right? Because it would be, you know, a hunk of furniture in your office that was, you know, being used by multiple people with their very advanced operating systems and whatnot, right? They were selling you the full service package, right? So,
yeah.
So it's just their entire business model was oriented towards the sort of everything's IBM, everything's, you know, we sell them for, you know, $100,000, not $600 out of the back of a Sears catalog.
Right. So they are acting out without fear the Orwellian scenario. They think they're just going to get bigger and bigger and more bigger, big industries will be using their computer, right? Is that what they're thinking? They just accept that. This bigness.
Oh, sure. They were computers. IBM was computers. They were the biggest. They were, you know, the thing, right? So, yeah, it was just hubris. And they'd been around for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. Like, nothing's going to stop them now, right?
Right. Now, this bigness, this is what is a major theme in McLuhan's Understanding Media in 1964, that people projecting bigness and more center margin centralization inevitability coming, McLuhan was unique in saying, no, it's going to flip into small user-friendly technology. See, that's where he was smart on. You know what I mean? Can you see that when you read Understanding Media, that his main astounding prediction that no one anticipated, because everybody's living inside the IBM icon and effect, they don't see how it's going to get friendly. It's just going to get worse and more impersonal. The hippies all rebelled against that. They used to have slogans in their communes based on don't spindle break or something, you know, some takeoff on an IBM slogan. That's what they were running from. And they thought they had to run away to the margins. And they didn't know that there were no more margins. Everybody was inside the central membrane, but that membrane was going to break up and fragment and give everybody their own throne. That's what McLuhan saw. And you have to realize nobody got that. They didn't get it until the 90s.
Right. As soon as he said, you know, artists will have the power to shape their very environment themselves and program their very environment, right? Like, that's exactly what he was getting at the heart of, right?
Yeah, and he also said, He also included the Orwellian on the level of the satellite environment means we program the whole Earth and its contents. The programming, Wyndham Lewis's The Art of Being Ruled, applies to the chemical body and the industrial structure. But nobody saw that there were new bodies, TV body and chip body, coming that will be parallel to the Orwellian. And the Orwellian has continued. You see that in the Patriot Bill. After 9/11, but the decentralization is equal to it, and society has to know where they're at now. Are we going 1984, or are we going to some crazy utopia of communication or something? That's where we're stranded, and so you get different parts of society have different levels of imagery of what's happening. They could be on the ear of the Orwellian.
Is your computer or is your tablet, is it a device for passive consumption? Is it a television 2.0, a newspaper 2.0? Or is it an active thing where you are, you know, choosing how to extend your senses and where to extend them and you know, whereby by a personally curating your own window on the world, right?
Yeah, you voluntarily determine what level you're going to be programmed by.
Yeah.
Okay, so those are the broader points. We'll maybe come back to that. So this guy talks about witnessing the ripoff of digital research by IBM. And then I know in the mythology that Steve Jobs came in and profited from this situation. He did something with IBM, right? Can you just, don't you touch
on
that?
Not with IBM, with Xerox PARC, with the experimental laboratories at Xerox.
Yes, he goes there in 79 and he sees things. Now, he mentions that he only saw one thing. He missed the other two. Was it okay that he just saw one thing?
He made the computer. Okay, he saw the graphical user interface, but he missed object-oriented programming and Ethernet networking. So when the Mac came out, it was, you know, it couldn't connect to a network, no Internet. And you couldn't program it. It wasn't right. Every other computer had been programmable, right? You sit there and you learn BASIC or you get a different language. The Mac was just like real computer users thought it was a toy. And by real computer users, I mean like people who had the Apple II, maybe, right? It was,
yeah. He missed the intertwining hive creation. He just thought it was a private object, like a book or a toy truck for a person.
Yeah, it's a little extension of your desk with virtual objects on it, right? You can type letters and stuff.
So he missed the networking. How did he recover from that? Did he do something correct?
Yeah, a few years later, better Macintoshes came out, which offered things like networking, and that might have even been after Steve Jobs was kicked out.
Right. Oh, like, did missing that cause him to be kicked out? Missing the Ethernet?
I don't think that was it precisely. I'm not well studied on the biography of Steve Jobs, so I'm not sure what it was exactly.
Okay, well, when we see the footage in 83 of the Macintosh, is that him brought back, or that's before he gets kicked out?
That's him just before he left. That's him just before they booted him out, yeah.
Right. So, let's see. An image I remember in the banks in the 70s, you'd see reel-to-reel kind of weirdness. What is that? Is that IBM computer mainframe?
It could have been IBM. A hard disk, a hard disk you can get at any of the information whenever you want. It's randomly accessible, but they're very expensive to create a hard disk. If you want to store a whole bunch of data and it can be linear, then tape is a very much cheaper form of computer storage. So, yeah.
So that's what I was witnessing, cheap storage.
Yeah, yeah, computer storage. Instead of a hard drive, you just have tape, which is a pain in the ass because you have to fast forward and rewind. You can't just look at the files in any order that you want, right?
Right. Okay, so at that time comes Pac-Man, and whatever other dinky stuff in the 70s. I was aware of what McLuhan was saying, but I said, this Pac-Man dinky, I had no interest in it. I said, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to sit around and watch something chew up something. You know what I mean? So
what's Pac-Man?
The image.
Oh, Pac-Man. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You, yeah.
Yeah, that's before really your time. Yeah, this is my documentary I'm quoting. And the triviality of computer life in the 70s kept me away from it. I had no interest in it. But then I was with Walter Boward in 82 out in Seattle area, and he had moved out there. He had started the Underground Press. Him and the LA Free Press, he did the East Village Other in New York, so he's an important journalist. But he had that thing that Steve Jobs is presenting in 83, but he had maybe an earlier version of it, unless it was 83. But he had some clunky big thing, and he was doing word processing. Or I don't know, he was just typing stupid little shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
That was my next image. After the reel-to-reel and then the Pac-Mans and whatever calculator stupid stuff was happening, I wasn't aware of the fairs that were happening 76, 77 in California. Forget what the homebrew fairs or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people were going and presenting their little inventions, and Jobs presented his. Maybe Gates did his. And that was I didn't know that was happening. So my next image is Walter Boward's word processor. But it's still isolating to me. You're just by yourself. I was into the analog broadcasting, connecting with everybody, or just being part of the emotion of multitude. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to get into that. Just like you're trying to figure out how to get something for yourself going in some role. I was trying to figure out how I could tell the world how I was the smartest guy in the planet. As I just posted on Alex on the McLuhan site a few hours ago, you might have seen it, where I said, art becoming science and science becoming art, which was a sentence in Take Today, which came out in 1972. That was really amazing. And I was the only person who saw that 40 years ago, or took it up and saw what was happening in art and science and the interplay. Did you see my post? And I got scolded again for bragging, but that was, I'm trying to express through that what I was excited by, how McLuhan could inspire you and Bucky Fuller and other people to be thinking you knew something that other people didn't know. Do you know what I mean? Well, you know what I mean because you feel that about yourself. You know this history better than other people or anybody who's interested in presenting it. You've got it down and you think you have something worthwhile to say, right?
I think so, yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah, and I think it's correct. And so, you know, that's I recognize your megalomania. I had it myself, but it was on the idea level. I thought if you get on there and talk it up, not that I would be trying to tell anybody something, but my savvy in responding to everybody's objections to me, claiming I knew it all, I knew I could play that really good. You know what I mean? Almost comedically. So... That's what I, so Walter, by himself, typing in a stupid word processor didn't seem significant to me. So, for what I want to do. So going back to your documentary, let's see, these dinky little floppy disk, DOS, what the hell is that? I mean, I remember having them, but is there a chip on them? What are they doing with these things?
Uh-huh. So you, well, your computer is full of microchips, right? So most of them are memory, RAM, and that's like the blank workspace for whatever it is you're working on your computer. But you need to fill it up with something, and so the disks have storage on them. They're magnetic. So there's a whole bunch of little magnetic spots with the ones and zeros that get loaded into memory. And when you turn the computer off, it all the RAM gets erased, right? So if you've got a hard disk in your computer, then you turn your computer on and it boots up. But those were very expensive in the 70s, so most of the computers ran off of the floppy disks. If you wanted to actually put software into your computer, it had to come off of a floppy disk. You needed the DOS, that's the operating system, and then once that was loaded into RAM, you could take it out and then put in a different floppy disk that had your word processor, and then once that was loaded into RAM, you could take it out and you can put in another disk that you saved your documents to, right? So So you're just swapping disks all day, in and out, because you don't have a hard drive.
Yeah, more nonsense that I was not attracted to. And also the corporate imagery of the employees and the scientists and researchers doing their little diddly stuff, the women with their punch cards. It's all so ancient, you know. The I don't even know if you understand the mood that that brings forth. But there's this proper little people, nicely coiffed at their jobs, sitting there. I don't know how they sit there all day, and organizing these papers and cardboards. They have no clue what chaos is going to happen because of this. See, that what's going to happen to the economy, what's going to happen to the 1979 when the interest rate go up to 20% because of the beginning of the digitization of the economy. So the imagery of these simple people in the 60s, 70s is interesting, okay? And then, let's see, you know, the women are there. They either got families or they're thinking of having a family. Or they might be a bit of a disco duck, but they're not aware of punk rock down in the village in the late 70s. They're not tuning into that. Patti Smith and the Ramones and other
Probably
people.
Probably not.
So,
yeah,
you don't. This corporate computer world is quite sterile in a way, but maybe most corporate offices are like that. So you see this sterility. And then, so I'm just going along with the imagery. Where does Doug, whatever his name is, the mother of all demos in '68? How does that interrelate what he shows